It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Staying healthy in the backcountry is a prerequisite to having a good time, but it's also more important than that. Getting sick in the wilderness away from healthcare can magnify the hazards of a situation. On today's show, we'll talk about health issues, mostly having to do with food and water, and how you can keep your group in good shape on backcountry or remote boating trips this summer. Safe drinking water is critical, and we'll have some details on that topic that even experienced outdoors folks might not know, coming from a microbiologist. We'll also talk about food, packing the right number of calories, and the simple but essential task of washing your hands in camp. Stick with me. I learned stuff today working on this show, and I think you will too. Well, my guest right now is Cindy Christian, who is with the Department of Environmental Conservation. She's the program manager for drinking water. And she is a microbiologist who knows about all those nasty little things that you do not want to be drinking when you're out on your backpacking trip or wherever you're going to be out this summer in the outdoors. Thanks for being with us, Cindy.
Thank you for having me.
And, I've actually, I don't think I've ever gotten sick from drinking water. I've always been careful to filter it, but there's a lot of little things that are in our water, even in areas that seem pristine and untouched by humans, that we need to be careful of. And what are some of the main microbiological issues that we need to think about with drinking water?
Well, the three main things that we need to talk about are protozoa, bacteria, and viruses. And everybody that lives in Alaska has probably heard of beaver fever, which is caused by a protozoa called Giardia. And Giardia is it comes in a cyst form, and you ingest that when you drink water. One of the other common protozoa in Alaska is Cryptosporidium. And both of these are carried by animals. So even if you are in a pristine area where there's not a lot of human activity, you do need to be worried about protozoa. So bacteria and viruses can also be an issue, although they are easily killed with any kind of disinfection. So Giardia and Cryptosporidium are two of the big things that we need to be worried about.
All right. So one of the things I've always wondered is how these things got out into areas that seem pristine, and I think actually when I was a kid we didn't really take that much care about this. We would just drink straight from streams, and maybe that was just because we didn't know any better, or maybe the problem spread over the course of my lifetime. Is it because of waterfowl, or is it because of what is carrying these protozoa like Cryptosporidium and Giardia out into the remote water bodies?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned with Giardia, there's a lot of animal hosts. One of the most common is actually dogs. Dogs are big carriers of Giardia. The other ones are beavers. So there are animal hosts, and then when they do their thing, they can contaminate drinking water. Cryptosporidium is more associated with moose and reindeer, caribou, muskoxen. So they're both pathogenic protozoan, and they have a similar life cycle in that they have an animal host, and when the animal excretes, the protozoans are in that excrement, and so in fecal matter, and that's how it enters into the environment. And then you mentioned a flowing stream, and I would say that if you are out and about doing any kind of outdoor activity, trying to get your water from a nice, clear flowing stream is always the best thing to do. It requires less treatment, and you're much more or less likely to pick up the protozoan in that type of water. But both of these organisms do like really cold water, so Alaska is a perfect habitat for these protozoan.
Interesting. Well, I want to get much more into how to avoid these things in a minute. And you already gave one good tip, which I heard since I was a little kid. It's always look for a fast-flowing stream that's, you know, well aerated and everything. But what, you know, if you get Giardia, then you are essentially this thing is going to live inside your body until you get rid of it with antibiotics or something, right? And the symptoms are pretty dreadful, which is going to be diarrhea and sometimes hard to diagnose if the doctor isn't really conscious of the fact that you might have been exposed, right?
Yes, that's correct. So the symptoms of Giardia and Cryptosporidium and any waterborne disease, so whether it come from bacteria or viruses or protozoa, are pretty much the same thing. And that, as you mentioned, that's diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal cramps, and things like that. It can be pretty severe. Giardia and Cryptosporidium both can be very severe illnesses. It just depends on the dose. Of course, the more cysts that you ingest, the worse your symptoms are going to be. And it depends on if you've had any previous exposure. People can build up an immunity to Giardia and Cryptosporidium. So it just depends on previous exposure too. But it can be a pretty dreadful, not fun to have either one of those.
Absolutely. But it doesn't hit you right away, right? You might not hit you until you're home, and you might think, oh my, I've got the flu, rather than think about exposure to tainted water from a camping trip.
Right. Both of those protozoas have a fairly long incubation time, and that is the period of time between when you ingest the protozoa cyst and when you start developing symptoms. And it can be up to 6 weeks before you begin to develop symptoms. So you're right. A lot of people might get it and then not even associate it with water that they drank 6 weeks ago. That is a little bit different for bacteria and viruses. Usually there's a much shorter incubation time in hours or days. So, it can certainly vary depending on the type of organism that you ingest.
All right. So I haven't really thought about viruses being in water, but I guess that makes sense. Bacteria could just be, again, in some kind of fecal matter that was got into the water. Is it sort of the same sources for the viruses and bacteria as for the protozoa?
It can be. Most bacteria and viruses, most waterborne diseases come from a fecal transmission. So you have a fecal-oral transmission line. So that means there's some type of waste fecal material that gets into the water, whether it be from humans or animals, and then it is ingested. And that is the route of transmission for all of these things. There are some viruses that are carried by waterfowl that can cause sickness in humans. Bacteria, the same thing. E. coli, I'm sure most people have heard about. They're most warm-blooded animals, so most mammals do carry some variety of E. coli, and that can be transmitted to humans, and it can cause some pretty bad sicknesses also.
Yeah. All right. So we've got people's attention now that you need to be careful. You mentioned, and I want to get into all the different ways of treating water. You mentioned that getting water from a fast-flowing stream is better than from a lake. I guess because the water in a lake or pool is just sitting there and sort of breeding these things, as opposed to a fast-flowing stream maybe coming right from an underground source or snowpack or something? Or what's the reason for that?
Well, I believe that the what you just said, water that's in a pool or is more or less stagnant, especially if it's warmer water, organisms can survive for quite a long time. So bacteria and viruses can survive a long time in those types of environments. Bacteria can actually replicate. Giardia, protozoans, cryptosporidium, viruses will not replicate in the environment. They have to be in a host in order to replicate. So it's just a function of the flowing stream. You know, you're washing away things. You're constantly renewing that source, basically. Mm. So that is very helpful, and that's certainly what you want to look for when you're out.
Yeah, makes sense. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm talking with Cindy Christian, who's with the Drinking Water Program at the Department of Environmental Conservation, and my name is Charles Woolforth. So you've got a few choices on how you're going to treat your water, and let's go through each of them in terms of pluses and minuses. One is a filter that you can carry and pump the water through the filter. Another is treating with iodine, and another is to boil the water. I guess boiling maybe is like the ultimate, right? But it's not very convenient, and it really requires you bring a lot of fuel, and then you end up with hot water. So you need to boil the water for quite a while to be really sure, right, Cindy?
Well, you only need to boil water for about 2 minutes to treat all of the, you know, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, whatever's in your water. Boiling is always the safest. So if you have that opportunity, that is, you know, the way to be safe. The other options too, it just depends on how much water you need. So, you know, how long is your hike going to be? How much do you want to carry? So it just depends on those types of things. And you mentioned iodine. That's not very effective. That is a disinfectant. It's not very effective. It's certainly not effective against protozoan, and it also tastes bad.
Yeah.
So most people don't want to drink that. So it's better probably to use some other methods.
The hand pumps are widely used and sold, and they're pretty easy to use. And you can carry them easily and get lots of water and get it right away. A few years ago, there was a little bit of a pulse of publicity about pumps when there were scientists who were saying, well, they don't really get rid of everything, and that there are some organisms that are simply too small for the pumps. What's your view on it? Do you think that the hand pumps, like the pure water filters, that are adequate, or do they have? Is there any drawback to using those?
Well, filtration is the first step in water treatment. So one of the things that you want to look at is how turbid is the water. So turbidity is a measure of the sort of the cloudiness. You know, you look at water, some of it's really, really clear, some of it is murky. That's called turbidity. So you always want to go with clear water. Filters are very effective, and you should always look at the manufacturer's recommendations or the manufacturer's settings on there, because it will tell you in the instructions what types of organisms they are rated to remove. Giardia and Cryptosporidium, especially Giardia, is a fairly large organism when you're talking about microbiological scales. So filtration is very effective in getting rid of Giardia and Cryptosporidium. Some filters will remove bacteria, but most don't, and there's hardly any that will remove viruses. They're, you know, viruses are just particles. They're very, very small, and so you would need to have something else to kill those viruses. One of the things that's pretty effective, and it has come out on the market in the last couple years, is UV treatment, so something like a SteriPen. Those are effective against viruses. Chlorine is also very effective. So after you filter the water, if you can get some chlorine into that water, that would make sure that you're getting rid of the bacteria and viruses also.
I see. Is that something that people actually do for outdoor trips, is take chlorine? I never heard of that, actually.
Yeah, they do have chlorine liquid in tablets that you can get at most outdoor stores.
Okay.
So they're kind of like the iodine, only chlorine is much more reactive than iodine. And, you know, most of us drink chlorinated water from a public water system, you know, such as AWW uses chlorine. So, you know, we're a little bit more used to that taste rather than the iodine. And chlorine is much more effective in getting rid of or inactivating viruses. But the UV, some of the newer technologies are out there. Like I mentioned, the SteriPen, they can be very effective in treating bacteria and viruses.
Interesting. So
they're very small, so it's easy to carry too.
I wasn't aware of that. So you're teaching me something, and probably a lot of the listeners too. That's pretty neat. What percentage of the illnesses that people get from these contaminants, if I call them that, from, you know, the outdoor setting, are from Giardia as opposed to viruses and bacteria? In other words, has anybody looked at it and said, well, you know, the Giardia takes care of most of the problem, and there's a small chance of getting viruses, or the virus is really a significant problem?
Well, I don't know the exact percentages, and I don't. The Health and Social Services epidemiology section does keep some numbers on those types of illnesses, although it's vastly underreported because most of the time people just get over it. They don't really go to the doctors. You know, if you have,
especially with a viral thing, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You have diarrhea for a couple of days and you just go, it's probably something I ate or whatever, you know, and most people don't go to the doctors, but they do have some statistics at Health and Social Services in the epidemiology section. I would say probably that the, people who do, eventually end up going to the doctor are people with protozoa infections because they're usually worse sometimes and they last longer, because with bacteria you can certainly have antibiotic treatment that will take care of the bacterial infections. Giardia, there is a drug that will that you can take that doctors can prescribe. There's really no drug for Cryptosporidium. So mostly that's just palliative care that, you know, they're just supporting, trying to keep people rehydrated and things like that. So it really depends on the illness that you get as to what types of treatments are available.
I see. And I know when we talk about water from wells and home water systems, there's a lot of issues about arsenic and the metals and other contaminants, but I'm guessing that the surface water that a hiker would be drinking would probably be pretty pure with respect to those kinds of issues, right?
Well, it just depends on what type of surface that surface water is running over.
Right.
If you're in an area, you know, where there's mining activity, certainly arsenic could be an issue in surface waters. In general, it is not an issue, but there are certain areas in the state where it could certainly be an issue. And I think that, you know, that's something for people to be aware of. You know, if you're in a mining area, you would certainly want to do some research before you go out and see what could possibly be in those surface waters.
Kind of be aware of where your water is coming from. There was an interesting map that I saw a few years ago of the contaminated surface water. I think that's what it was in Prince William Sound. There are so many historic mines there that it was just pockmarked all over the place. And so that seems like a really good thing to be aware of, that when you're gathering water, just think about where it came from.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Cindy. This has been really interesting. I've learned a lot. Cindy Christian, Program Manager for Drinking Water at the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. My guest right now is Paul Twardock, who's been on the show many times, professor of outdoor studies at APU. And he's done a lot of trips. He's led a lot of trips. Actually, leading trips is probably you're thinking more about health and safety than you are when you're doing it on your own, because other people are relying on you. And so we're going to talk about safe water, what kind of food to bring, how to cook your food, all these issues about food and water in the backcountry that relate to being safe and coming back healthy. So thanks for being here, Paul.
Thanks for having me again, Charles.
So we're talking to a real live microbiologist about Giardia and all these other nasty things that you can get. But there's practicalities to how you deal with water, one of which is, at least I've never really enjoyed doing the boiling method for purifying water very much, because then you have hot water, right? And,
yeah.
And you might want to drink it soon, right? And you may mean carrying a lot of water around all day, and also a lot of fuel to boil all that water. I mean, how much fuel do you have to bring if you're going to do a trip with just boiling? Quite a bit.
Well,
right?
So I think about water, and well, being in the outdoors in general, I think about hydration and food, and it's super important to stay hydrated. And then, so then I start to think when I'm planning, well, where am I going? How many people am I going to have? What are my water sources going to be? And what kind of stove I'm going to have? And when you get into, to answer your question about how much fuel to bring, if you're going to be, let's say, boiling water, which I do, I actually, that's a pretty common way for me to treat my water, mm-hmm. is I just boil it some up before I go to bed at night, mm-hmm. and I'll have a liter. Sometimes if it's cold out, I like to put that hot water bottle in my sleeping bag with me,
okay.
sort of a nice little treat. And by the morning, it's cooled off, and by the day, by noon, when I'm drinking it or during the travel day, it'll be, you know, plenty cooled off and cool. So that's one way to manage that. As far as the amount of fuel to bring, I go by a general rule of if I'm using white gas, like Coleman fuel, I'll bring, estimate 1 liter for 3 to 4 people for about 3 days, right? And so that's one way to estimate fuel. For if you're going out for an overnight, you can also think about, you know, around about 1 to 2 ounces of fuel per person per day.
Okay.
So that's a sort of another way to look at it. Maybe, you know, more on the 2 ounce end of things. There's some you can get online, and MSR and the REI have different formulas, and it gets super complicated. But I use the 1 liter for 3 or 4 people for 3 or 4 days pretty consistently, and it seems to work quite well.
Okay.
Now, if you have a canister, those typically for 2 people, what they I think they come
these
in,
are like the butane,
canisters.
It's sort of compressed, and so that it
right.
comes out because it's under pressure.
Yeah. Those typically they're sort of a small can. I got about 110 grams, and then a larger canister. Usually, one smaller canister will go for 2 people for a weekend outing,
mm-hmm.
right? And so,
what are those little jet things called?
The jet boil.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of people like those. I mean, you're sort of dealing with a small amount of water with those, but it's very fast.
Yeah. So stoves. Those are work great except for wind. And so things that affect fuel are temperature, wind, and obviously the amount you're going to be, altitude, and the amount mm-hmm. you're going to be boiling. So in anything under about 20 degrees, you want to have the white gas. The butane starts to not work so great.
Right.
Also at altitude, I've read that about when you go up about 10,000 feet, it actually doubles your boiling cooking time. So again, with those butane stoves, so you would need more fuel the higher you go, basically. Generally not an issue in South Central Alaska, but if you're in mountaineering in the Alaska Range or up in the Wrangells, that would be a bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. Why do you like boiling best? What's your preference for that? Is it just because it's thorough?
It's thorough. I like my hot water bottle in bed at night.
Okay.
I'm not bringing a bunch of other gadgets. I have a stove. I have a pot already, right?
It.
And so I don't have to worry about, do I have a pump? Do I have, you know, my chemicals and so forth and so on. Now, I'll also always have some iodine or chlorine tablets to also treat. And sometimes if I'm sea kayaking, I'll bring a pump. If I'm not worried about weight, then I'll bring a pump along.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of pump do you favor?
Well, I have an MSR, mm-hmm. But you know, there's a ton of
there's
different
There's a million
models
of them, and they're
there,
very...
Right.
Well, some people love getting gadgets, right?
Right, I'm not a gadget person.
Me neither.
But I know that the advantages of the pumps are that they are very thorough. They're very effective at what they do. They are slow. They do require maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the pumps. There's also SteriPens, that sort of UV, you stick it in there, you flip a switch, and it uses UV to sterilize.
Mm-hmm.
And those are fairly popular and fairly effective. However, they require a battery and electricity, which when you mix with water, sometimes it doesn't work too well.
Right.
There's also the chemicals. There's iodine, which is not necessarily recommended for pregnant women, for instance, or people with thyroid issues.
And our other guest mentioned that they also taste bad.
They taste bad, yeah. Right. Yeah, they taste bad.
That used to be the go-to thing years ago.
Right. And then there's chlorine tablets, too, which is actually a chlorine mix what I use, which seems to work fairly well. And those take a little while. You can't expect to have something to drink right away.
Right.
So,
do you have different procedures when you're leading a trip as to when you're going on your own?
Not really. I tell people, a lot of people say, well, should I treat my water? And I say, well, do you care if you get sick? Right. So if you don't care if you get sick, don't treat your water. But if you don't want to get sick, treat your water.
Yeah.
It used to be in Alaska.
You didn't have to worry about it.
And like I'll take Prince William Sound for an example. Before the oil spill, never really an issue out there. Then at the oil spill, we had about 10,000 people out there cleaning up beaches, pooping in the woods. And all of a sudden, we started to see cases of Giardia and people getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's out there.
And it's almost everywhere, I think.
Right, yeah. So treat your water and be safe.
And be safe, right.
Yeah.
So if you're leading students and somebody's not careful and you must have probably ended up with a situation where somebody was pretty sick.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I haven't had anybody terribly sick, but generally they'll, because we're pretty careful, but generally someone, get a little diarrhea mm-hmm. and not feel good. And a lot of times it's just... the diet, started in rice and things are easy to digest, and over a day or two it'll pass.
These things aren't life threatening; they just make you incredibly miserable.
Yeah, right, and occasionally, way back when I was working in Wyoming, we had about a half a group of 30 people come down with Giardia, and that was a trip to the hospital. That everybody ended up in the ER. Getting prescription drugs for it. So,
wow.
Because they're pretty sick. Yeah.
Did you have to get them flown out or something?
No, it was a travel thing. What we were doing, uh-huh. We're traveling. We stopped and got our water. We sent some kids out to get some water. They're, oh, wow, a mountain stream, a clear mountain stream. And they filled it up. Our duds, everybody drank it. And it turned out, where did you get this water from? And there was a big... a pasture full of sheep upstream, and a lot of people got sick from that. So
you just a little common sense.
Right. And I think when you're looking at water, you're looking at your water source is super important too. And what is it? Does it look clean? What's upstream from it? And then sort of analyze it. And I, once in a while, if something's coming right off a glacier and I don't see the animals up there, I'll drink it straight. So mm-hmm. it's sort of a pleasure to drink something that's
Yeah, sometimes you can see it coming right out of a snowfield or out of the ground or something.
Yep.
Yeah. So when you're planning trips, you're thinking about not only how much fuel, but how much food, how much water everybody needs,
mm-hmm.
and figuring out the right amount of calories and the right balance of the diet and so forth. Because you probably don't, at least certainly with students, you're not gathering food as you go.
We do a little bit, but not
do
much.
You? Yeah, okay. Berries and stuff like
Berries and fish. Uh-huh. But we avoid shellfish for sure.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into shellfish a little bit later, but sort of what rules of thumb do you have for how you pack in terms of how you figure out the right amount of food and what people need?
Well, there's different ways of planning. I had a friend once that would just walk into Fred Meyer's and start buying stuff, right? And then we'd walk out and hope we had enough. Usually we had way too much.
Right.
And that's typically what happens when you go in there. And so...
can do it. You can plan it each meal and measure everything out, which has the advantage that you're going to have essentially what you need on the right day, but it takes a long time.
Right,
and it's kind of a pain. And then maybe you end up with some Tupperware thing of beans that you never use, or you can sort of figure out, well, these are the general ingredients I usually use, and I'll figure it out as I go.
Right. For most of the trips I do, either personal or with a group, I make a menu. Mm-hmm. So I have a menu. I actually have a spreadsheet that I figure out the items, and just make a menu with ingredients,
mm-hmm.
and I'll figure out, well, how much do I want of each ingredient per person, and I just have that. And so every trip I do, I just figure, well, this trip's 7 days long, and we have four people, and I can use that for larger groups.
It's a handy way to do it, because if you've done it right, then you can just turn it into a shopping list, right? You can just print it out as a shopping list.
Off. Yeah.
And you can change it each time. You don't have to eat the exact same thing. You just change it a little bit.
Yeah. So I have set items that we take. I try to balance it with fats and carbohydrates and protein. So carbs being probably 40 to 60% of that. And that's sort of inevitable. You're eating a lot of pasta and rice, mm-hmm. and beans and stuff. Then I'll have some fat in there, whether it's cheese, dairy products of some sort, butter, margarine, and oils, and then I'll have some protein. So whether it's beef jerky or canned salmon or some sort of protein.
Which can be one of the harder items to get towards the end of the trip. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you like have some perishables at the beginning and then?
It depends on what I'm doing, mm-hmm. but for boat-based trips, for sure, we'll bring fresh veggies and even eggs, and raft trips, boy, you can really go hog wild and stuff if you want to. But you have to be careful with that. You still have to carry the stuff around. So,
right. Do you have like a rule of thumb about how many calories to bring along, or just sort of know sort of by experience?
Yeah. So the rule, one rule of thumb is that you and I sitting here in the studio, we're probably burning somewhere around 1,200 of 1,500 calories just per day, basically. And when you start, let's say we're going to go backpacking, every hour, all of a sudden that bumps up to another 300 calories per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so depending on the activity, and boating, paddling, kayaking, rafting, canoeing, you're going to probably be going on 100 to 150 more calories per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do the math and figure it out. But typically, you're going to want 2,000 to 3,000 calories, maybe up to 4,000 calories for summer activities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for extreme winter activities or endurance events, you might be doing as much as 5,000 to 7,000 calories.
Right.
If you're winter camping, winter mountaineering, like Denali right now, you might be planning on 6,000 to 7,000 calories. A lot of that's going to be in fat.
It's really hard to take that much on board.
Yeah. And that's in fat. I mean, you're taking butter, margarine, bacon, whatever you can.
And people will actually just eat a stick of butter.
I've seen it, yes. Or I have been known to put butter in my hot chocolate when I'm winter camping.
Yeah.
So.
And if you don't, then you will not stay as warm.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing how much that fat, the Native Indigenous people had it right. You eat a lot of fatty things, you're going to stay warm.
Yeah. So. My friend Jeff Kennedy mushed to the North Pole from the tip of Ellesmere Island. It was one of these situations where they're eating massive amounts of calories, still losing weight.
Yeah.
And his comrades ended up looking like they'd come out of a prison camp, whereas he started with a pot belly and he came out looking about right. He said that the ideal and what a lot of Alaska natives sort of have is fit but fat.
Yeah.
So you've got some energy stores on board, but you're still fit. You still have that good cardiovascular system.
Yeah. Many endurance athletes will bulk up before, especially these long wilderness trips. They'll mm-hmm. actually bulk up before you go out, which is tough because you're also trying to get in shape. So it's this combination of, well, I need to exercise to get in shape, but I want to add some stores on. So that's a tough thing to do. Actually.
Right, and you can't switch to being a couch potato if you're eating that way.
Right,
you'll very quickly get fat.
Yeah.
Outdoor Explorer, our guest right now is Paul Twardock, and who's professor of outdoor studies at APU, and we're talking about food and water in the outdoors. So, Paul, you alluded to the question of, do you pick up clams and mussels and eat them? They're incredibly appealing when you're out on a backcountry boating trip. They're so delicious, and there's really nothing quite as nice as sitting in the sunset on a beach, and you've paddled or you've boated to this location. You've got this delicious seafood, but you're skeptic. You're not going to go for it.
Well, I am. I'm very, very careful with shellfish and mussels, primarily because you don't really know what kind of algae blooms happen mm-hmm. or in the recent past. And it takes a while for the toxins to get out of their meat. I'm very, very careful with that. You know, I might harvest one in an area that's generally maybe farther away from a town, where they're, because they're filter feeders, so they'll filter anything that comes through the water. So, and a lot of times in Alaska have some degree of sewage going out into the ocean. Mm-hmm. So I just avoid the areas around the towns. And then I, you know, if I find something, oh, this is really cool, and I've asked around, so I'll have known if other people are eating them, if anybody's known of algae blooms in them, because that's what, again, creates the toxin that gets in their system. And then I might just take a little bite and taste it and see if I get any tingling in my tongue or my lips. And if I do, that's it, right? So very, very careful. Maybe just consume a little bit to start with and see.
Have you had that experience where you've gotten?
I have not, but I've had students had it before. Uh-huh. And a little bit scary.
We had terrifying, it's very. It can easily be fatal. Paralytic shellfish poisoning and stops your, essentially paralyzes you so that you don't breathe.
Right. Yeah.
So. So what are the symptoms? How would you know that you're getting it?
Oh, well, tingling lips, tightness in the throat. Blue lips, blue tongue. I had a kid actually go into convulsions once.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was a little scary.
And that was on a backcountry trip?
Yep. And we don't know if 100% sure that was caused it, but it sure was suspicious.
Yeah.
And he recovered. He was fine. A little scary moment there.
A really scary moment. Yeah, yeah. Well, and I guess something I'd add to your list is if I was in a spot where I knew that help was not available, I might be more skeptical about doing a lot of risky things, including eating shellfish. Whereas if I was in a spot where I knew that if there was a problem, we could get medical attention, then I might be a little bit more willing to do it. And so PSP, what I've learned, and I'm so far from being an expert, I hope you'll correct me, is if the person does have trouble breathing, you can keep them alive with mouth-to-mouth respiration until you get some kind of care. So you don't want to just give up on a person.
Oh, yeah, never give up on anybody, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, healthy adults, you'll probably be all right. But
probably depends on your dosage, too.
So forth and that. But my bottom was I just don't. I'm pretty conservative with it, and I've had enough students get sick either with PCP or just generally bad intestinal issues that I just avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
When I don't know where I'm at or what's happened, I just avoid them.
Yeah. So I think berries are pretty safe. Fish is safe, but needs to be cooked pretty thoroughly, I think.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
What's your, do you, any advice on that?
Cook it. I do you know, I'll soak it in lemon juice and sort of have that sort of cook. That's a way to cook it, so that's a fantastic thing.
Tell me what you did. Sprinkle lemon juice.
Juice and some salsa, and those acids actually cook it up a little bit. And that's a wonderful way to have fish. But again, better off cooking it, and so you're better off either frying it up or steaming it or whatever you're gonna do.
Better, definitely better safe than sorry. Far from help.
In one of the cases, that guy that I mentioned, that went into convulsions, he had eaten some raw fish with a mussel, had eaten a mussel. So that it was a greenling is the name of the fish. It had some mussel in it, and he ate, that we found out this later, he'd eaten the fish meat raw, and then he got pretty sick.
Oh, that's
amazing.
And
so we talked to our medical advisors, and they're like, well, it's possible that the fish then had the toxin in the meat. It was just diluted enough where he had a little delayed reaction to it. So,
and it's important to know that PSP is not killed by cooking, and it's not killed by freezing. So
right. Oh, yeah.
You could have a year-old clam that's been frozen and cook it thoroughly, and you'd still get PSP from it.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time, but you know that. What other kinds of health issues do you prep for? I mean, I always think about bug repellent and head nets if necessary. I'm a big proponent of seasick remedy. If you're going to be spending time on a boat, you're just going to have a much better time. Any other things you'd throw in the pot?
Well, I think the biggest thing, because it's one of the most common ailments in the outdoors is sanitation. Like just basic having some hand sanitizer along, washing your hands before you eat, all the time, after you go to the bathroom. I think that's a huge thing. Also, keeping your pots
and you set up your campsite so that automatically when you come back into the campsite, before you touch anything, you wash your hands.
Wash your hands, yep. I think that's a huge thing, especially in groups of people who don't necessarily, you're not family, you're not living, and you're not used to each other's bugs. And
it's easy
stuff.
To forget, too.
Right. So that's one thing. I think bugs are important, like bug protection. I've seen many people, you'll get a bug bite, start itching it with a dirty hand, and get an infection. And I've had at least two, possibly three people in groups get staph infections from that. A little bug bite, a little scratch with a dirty hand, and boy, they got an infection pretty bad. So that sanitation is super important. And just generally, like, you know, what you're eating, when you're eating, how much you eat, how you cook it, you know, paying attention to that a little bit is really important for an enjoyable trip. You don't want to get sick. Usually people go on trips, they're already tired. They've been running around getting prepped. You haven't slept a lot. You get out to where you're going to go, and maybe you're with some new people, and you're susceptible, and your body's being stressed by physical activity. So you're susceptible to little bugs and viruses out there for the first couple days. And so just practicing good sanitation, treating your water, cooking your food well, eating well, like having good meals, eating a lot during the day while you're exercising. You know, being in the outdoors is an endurance activity. You're not like we're sitting around on our couches. You start at 6, 7, 8 in the morning, and you're going all day long. So constantly snacking, drinking, staying hydrated all during the day. I mean, you should really drink about 3 to 4 liters of liquid a day. Like probably 3 liters and another liter with all the food you cook. That's a lot for most people. And then I would just put a plug in, you know, watch your alcohol. I mean, you know, a lot of people getting out, especially around water, get in trouble with alcohol.
Yeah.
So just be mindful of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to get hurt with when you don't have good judgment, which is what you get rid of with the alcohol. Great. Well, thanks, Paul. This has been really interesting. I always enjoy having you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So Paul Twarduk is a professor of outdoor studies at APU. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. Charles Woolforth here, and we've been talking today about safe food and water in the backcountry. And so many of these issues we've discussed may seem obvious, like wash your hands. You know, bring along something to wash your hands and wash your hands in camp so you don't get sick. Treat your water. Make sure that you are drinking healthy water so you don't get Giardia or other things that could make you sick. It may seem obvious, but people still do them and still make these mistakes and get sick and ruin their trip. So that's what we're talking about today on Outdoor Explorer. And I wanted to get into the food aspect a little bit more because we have this amazing ability in Alaska to, you know, somewhat live off the land, catch fish and eat shellfish. But we need to be careful about that because it's not always safe, and paralytic shellfish poisoning is a major hazard in Alaska, a growing hazard. And to discuss that, I have a guest from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. George Scanlon is the shellfish permit coordinator there at the Food and Safety Food Safety Sanitation Program. Thanks for being with us, George.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, sir.
Thank you. So the issue of paralytic shellfish poisoning is something that can be tested for, But it's not a simple test, and in fact, most places in Alaska are not tested. So if you are gathering clams or mussels on a remote beach, there's really, for the general public who's doing that on their own, they don't have any way of knowing, correct?
That is certainly correct. Paralytic shellfish poisoning is certainly a great concern to the state. It has a dark history in Alaska, as you may know. The public needs to be very aware and careful if they are to go out to harvest shellfish.
And the problem is increased, as I understand it. It goes back centuries, and there's records of Alaska natives being stricken and dying even, in 200 years ago. But now the problem seems to be becoming more severe, certainly here in South Central Alaska. True?
What we saw last year was that we are seeing some shellfish with levels that are above the regulatory level, which is 80 micrograms per 100 grams of tissue. Of course, as you may understand, this is the commercial program that we monitor in the state. Samples of some of the, that we have tested in the South Central area did show some high levels of toxin, and seems to be a trend that way.
Mm-hmm. So is this because they're picking up the toxin from algae that's growing, and possibly because of the ocean waters being warmer?
That is one assumption, is that the warm weather seems to be account for the increase in the in this algae that the shellfish feeds on. This last year we saw several areas in the South Central, like in the Kachemak Bay, that we've never seen those levels, but it's there. And like you indicated, that seems to be the general thought, is that we would probably anticipate to see this in the rise.
Yeah. So if you are gathering mussels or digging clams, there's no way to tell just from looking at them if they are safe to eat.
Yeah. So, it's important for the folks to know the facts. It's hard to tell if the water is, if these toxins, these algae are in the water, red colored water is not a reliable predictor of toxin conditions. Some people tend to associate, this with red tides. That's not quite true, because, toxic conditions may be present in colorless water. Some people think that the toxins are related to water pollution. That's not quite true. PSB toxins, as we have talked before, is found in high concentration in all of the Alaska coastline. And what we have also seen is that there are three basic areas that have that kind of troublesome. And this is the Kodiak Island area, and then we also have the Aleutian and the Southeast. But recently, like I said, like last year, we saw some hot samples coming out of the Kachemak Bay area, and even up in the north, Prince William Sound. So
wow, so it's getting kind of everywhere now, and that's something that folks who are very experienced may not be ready for. So even if you've eaten mussels and clams from a particular beach in the past, doesn't mean it will be safe in the future.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. There's no guarantee to that one. So.
And so cooking is not going to get rid of these toxins. That's not a solution. On the other hand, as I understand it, finfish like salmon or cod will not be affected by the toxins. And if you cook your finfish, you'll for most part be able to kill any parasites or anything else that would be harmful. Is that essentially true?
That is essentially true. most of the finfish, you know, don't feed on these bivalves or even, you know, these plankton. So the only reason some of the fish may be toxins is when they, you know, consume or they eat something that that may feed on these algae and might get the toxin. So cooking salmon or cod or most of the finfish is safe. It's good.
I got you.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that if you are gathering shellfish from near, say, an oyster farm, they're okay because the oysters have been measured and they're okay. But that's not necessarily the case, is it? I mean, or is it? If you're near a commercial operation, does that mean you're okay to be gathering shellfish?
It's hard to say because you never know where these things are, but generally, if you're in the area that's within, for the commercial, the oyster farms are pretty much, you know, in a location that is tested, and we deem the commercial product okay. If you're going for the wild, you know, shell stock, it's hard to know. It's very unpredictable, you know, mm-hmm. where these PSP events occur. So we have seen that we have a clam, a mussel in the same area, a couple of yards apart, and when they test it, it comes out different. One may be clean. A little neck clam may be clean, but a butter clam next to that little neck is hot, so it's hard to predict.
Yeah. So you mentioned the different kinds of species, and I've been told that what we call steamer clams, and I don't know what the technical name for them, but they're the smaller clams, are less likely to have PSP than the large butter clams, which, and I don't know why that would be or if that's even true.
That is our experience of what we're seeing in the test, the lab test. The little necks, or the I think that's maybe the steamer ones mm-hmm. that you're referring to, the smaller ones, tend to be a little, you know, tend to have, you know, a whole toxins less than the butter clams. It's like, you know, what we've seen is that it can be as long as 2 years or more for the butter clams. Little necks, it's hardly, you have a hard sample of that one. So, yeah.
Wow. So the butter clams hold it in their digestive system for a long time period. So they'd be the worst one for you to go for. What about mussels? Mussels churn through water pretty quickly, right? Are they, where would they be on your spectrum of the amount of hazard that different shellfish have?
Mussels, I think, is also, we call them scavengers of the sea. They tend to be, what we have seen is that they tend to take in the toxin pretty fast and then also depurate it or let it go pretty fast because these are, you know, filter feeders, and mussels seems to be very, they ingest and, you know, take in and pumped out, you know, many gallons of water, you know, per minute. They tend to, if there is a bloom nearby, they get to be hot pretty fast. And we sometimes use these, or it's used in other programs as a sentinel species to kind of monitor the bloom. If there is a suspected bloom of the toxin algae, The mussels will be the first one to look, you know, to check, because they will be a good indicator that there is a bloom in the area. Mm. And then again, they would depurate, like I said, they will get rid of the toxin faster. So it's what we call a good species for kind of monitoring the if there is an incoming bloom in the area.
Right. So it picks up everything. If you're eating mussels, you're eating whatever's in the ocean, right? Yeah. But they're so delicious. What are there seasonal issues, like times of year, or weather issues that, that affect this?
That's what we have seen, is that the blooms and the toxins seems to occur in the summertime. For the South Central area, we noticed that some of these toxins are showing up towards the later part of the summer, towards the fall, and then after around October, after late September or even mid October, we're getting to see the results get normal again. But there seems to be a window in the summer, especially in the South Central area, that appears to be a uptick of the toxin, and especially in reference to last year's data that we saw.
Interesting. Is there anything? Is there any kind of test kit that we can purchase, or anything that folks who are wanting to continue to do their clam digging traditions can do that would be obviously short of your high level state lab, but would give a little more confidence? Or is that something that's just not possible?
There are several that I know of. Some of the test, what they call the screening test, available. One of them is a Gillette mist test, probably still available for, it's just a quick field test to see what kind of levels of toxin in the water. It's not used for regulatory because sometimes they give false positives. But there are a few, and that's one that comes to mind.
I see. And so someone could do some research and find those, presumably on the internet or something.
That is the best way to do it. Yes, I mean, you can go online and just test for some of those PSP field tests available. Right. Yeah.
And I'm just curious, George, if you are a shellfish lover, if you eat shellfish yourself.
I do. I love shellfish. I love razor clams. The razor clams are coming good over at the at the west side of the Cook Inlet.
Uh-huh.
There is a commercial harvest area over there that we monitor. So I love to take those. I love to eat those razor clams. Oysters. I love oysters. It's a great. Alaska oysters are the best.
They are truly amazing.
It's grown on on pristine waters, I strongly I really like Alaska oysters, and certainly can recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, I love them on the half shell with just a little lemon, or a little cocktail salt. It's so delicious. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much. This has been interesting and informative. And my guest has been George Scanlon, who's the shellfish permit coordinator for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thanks for being with us, George.
Thank you, sir.
And that's all for today's show on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer, who found today's guest, is Hannah Doro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.